Welcome to The Study. I'm Craig Robertson, bringing you a program dedicated to the life of the mind. In this podcast, we talk to Lynn Parkleasy, urban environmental planner. Lynn has an interesting story that I think demonstrates very well that if you have a propensity for a life of the mind, an openness to ideas, nothing will stop you developing that. As you'll hear, Lynn came through a tough migrant background to go on to university and do law, and ultimately urban planning, and then a growing involvement with environmentalism, all the while exploring new ideas. I visited Lynn in his study in suburban Melbourne.
I was born to Italian parents. They were hardly literate. My father would have done no more than 1 or 2 years at school, and my mother may have done 3. So, no, there were no books in the house. Music, yes, I'll come back to that. No books. In fact, by the time I was in sub-intermediate, and we did literature for the first time, and it was Robinson Crusoe, I passed it by reading the comic strip in Ginger Meggs. So there was no sense of literary background at all. And in fact, while they didn't scoff at books, they thought it was unnecessary to buy them. So it was a very, it wasn't anti-intellectual, but it was certainly, there was no tradition of any sort. Music, completely different. We didn't have a record player or anything like that. I'm talking about the late 30s now. But we certainly listened to Italian music, singers on the radio and so on.
Opera?
Opera, very strong, right? As much as you could get, although there wasn't a hell of a lot at the time, right? But every Sunday night we always turned the radio on and listened to World Famous Tenors, I think it was called, and so on. So that music thing is with me now, and it's with me so strongly that I always cry when I listen to Italian music. It evokes the sound of my family, my parents, an understanding of that world that they came from, and so on. Whatever happens in the future about life on Earth, I expect that music will always be there. It's a dimension.
One of the things I'm interested in here is the genesis of a sense of beauty.
Other things like the visual, painting, all that sort of stuff, that didn't exist either. I mean, it was a pretty sad time. It was the sort of the Depression years and other kids in the back streets and things like that. There was no artistic things. Music was the only thing that it impinged on us. But there's another important part to the intellectual life thing, and that is the sense of contrast between Australian society and Italian society. Mm-hmm. And I was forever being told about, you know, how things are different and so on. Now, my parents were both fitters in. Dad had come here at the age of 16 in 1922, and he went to dances, balls, you name it. He loved life here. Mum arrived in 29, two months before Wall Street collapsed, right? And so life was hard and brutish. They met here and married here. They always talked about, you know, so I had this constant contrast, so much so that if I was with Italians, I was pro-Australian, and therefore putting that case, right? If I was with Australians, I was always putting the Italian version of things. Yeah. It was a contrasting thing that was working away at my skull as a young kid. Now, I think that's an important formative thing. I mention here another aspect of it all, and that is the business in the shop. I mean, I would never have seen this then as any sort of environmental consciousness or anything. But my parents were very conscious of good quality fruit and vegetables.
Fruit and veggie shop.
That's right. He knew about sprays. Wash it. Don't pick up the fruit and eat it the way it is. Wash it. And we knew about only eating fruit in season. I think it's a very important thing, that. I mean, today I suspect people don't know that thing. They don't think about it, and they don't know about it.
Going to uni, parents obviously supported that pretty strongly.
Let's finish off St Kevin's College, right? In the last couple of years there, I had a couple of very good teachers and some very interesting friends. The friend was in particular a guy called Terry McKenna, who later went off and became a Dominican priest. And I can remember him, and not, you know, at lunchtime you weren't allowed to play football, you had to walk and talk, or just sit down, or sit down on the seats, but you weren't allowed to play football. They just reconstructed the gardens and
this
all
is
that.
St Kevin's?
St Kevin's, Toorak, yeah. Yeah. But it only brought it in the last years, the last couple of years. But as I say, they'd reconstructed the garden, done up the building, and so on. It's not the new building. It's
what order ran that school?
They're just the Christian Brothers.
Christian Brothers.
Yeah. Basically bashers who were absolutely wrong for me in the sense of being such a timid kid. I knew that every Monday I turned up, I would get the strap for the mistakes I made in the Friday test. And it was just devastating for me. I suffered terribly as a result of it. And talk about confidence and all that. I mean, it was just... So I see Terry McKenna and so on with other kids walking the paths and talking about things like the YCW, Young Christian Workers. I don't know if you know any of the Catholic background, but that's important.
I've heard of them.
Yeah. It was a Catholic action movement, not a la Santa Maria, but a la spirituality. The workers in factories, it started in France, it's the workers in France going into factories, being interested in the whole lives of the other workers and so on, right? And their spiritual development and so on. And Terry McKenna used to argue with other kids about this. Now, he got it from St Dominic's East Camberwell, where they had a strong YCW. And I remember never being part of those discussions, but being utterly impressed by his commitment. Right?
Mm.
And I suppose that's the first sign of any doing something for somebody else, right? That I actually came across. I had two good brothers, both of them in their field, one in English and English, French, all those sorts of things. And they actually asked questions about things, right? It wasn't the normal Catholic education where you learnt the catechism, you learnt the answers, how do we know God exists, you know, all that sort of stuff. They actually turned over issues of whether your population growth was a good thing or whatever. I remember being very affected by that, stirred by that. Okay, so we leave St Kevin's, I fail because of my English, I was hopeless at writing. And I went and worked for a year in a milk bar. Another important influence that's like my father, this notion of doing it best. Very, very proud, but very, very determined about it all.
Yeah.
So off we go to the university. Now, I was extremely lucky.
Well, were you studying? Did you have to pass the English?
How did I get into law? This story is amazing.
You must have been doing
this
some...
What happened was the first year I was in the milk bar. The second year I decided to give it up. I hated it, being the 7 day a week thing and all that stuff. And my father opened a fruit shop in East Malvern. So I went with him. Within about 6 months, we were arguing, as fathers and sons do. And I decided in the last 3 months of the year to go to Taylor's and do a few subjects that I'd failed, which I did, and passed. So I was going to go to the university.
So there was a lot of self-motivation.
Yeah, that's right, obviously. And I was in the YCW thing and all that, but I was very mixed, you know. But the interesting story is that I said to Mum, today is the last day I have to sign up for the university. And she said, what are you going to do? And I said, well, with the odd subjects I've got, I can do either arts or law. And she said, what's arts? And I said, well, you know, you do this and, on commerce. So if you do commerce, you can become an accountant. If you do arts, maybe a teacher or something like that. And she said, what about law? And I said, oh, I couldn't do law. I had no self-confidence, you know, that you believe that you had to get up there and stand up there and talk and all that stuff. And she said, but with teaching and commerce, you can't be your own boss. And I said, no. And she said, well, do law. So I said, oh, right. So I got on the train and went to university. It was the first thought I'd ever had in my whole life of doing law. So I went there and I loved it. I failed badly because I didn't work very hard as in the later years because of another thing, you see. It was marvellous because I was caught up in a wonderful blossoming of Catholic intellectual studies, and I've got papers and so on.
It's Melbourne University.
We're talking about Melbourne University. We're talking about 1954. The height of it all was about 52-3 to 62-3, about 10 years. Well, and right in the middle of it. Although I gave a few talks at pneumocity camps. And again, once again, it's about the spiritual dimension of life. It was getting away from the Catholic defensive notion, the notion that people talking about Catholic jockey wins on Catholic horse, you know, the notion that you're a tribe and you're defending your tribal land. Mm. Another notion, for example, Bill Ginnane, as a philosopher, said the way priests are taught is that, you know, they set up Thomas Aquinas, you learn that, and then with all other philosophies, you give it a tick or a cross, depending on whether it agrees with Aquinas. Whereas he said the notion should be that you take an issue, a human problem, and you bring in all the great thinkers, including Aquinas, all the great thinkers of the world, and see what they've said about it, and you meditating on it and so, reflecting on it and so on. In other words, it was taking Catholicism out of that tribal, Irish, defensive clique, and putting it in there amongst everybody else, encouraging you, which is something which is extremely important to me, associate with those places and those people where development is occurring, where the thinking and so on. And in fact, there was one common expression amongst everybody said, we were attacked for not getting involved in charitable works and all those sorts of things, you know, joining the St. Vincent de Paul Society or whatever. And instead the notion was, no, there is a charity to think. The world is developing. People suffer and grow as a result of that, and so you'd be involved with it.
I'm interested in the ethical dimension, which is really what you're fleshing out here. Were there any particular issues during that decade that you've mentioned, like the bomb, for example?
It was the Hungarian, uprising, all that. That was discussed. It was pre-Vietnam, and Vietnam sort of destroyed the unity of the human society quite a bit. Education was very important, right, in their discussions. Most of the senior guys in the place were teachers of one sort or another, either at school or university. And this notion of the university's true life is to seek the truth, that was floated publicly. You were able to say it in those days. that was what Christians had to think about to help promote that notion, really.
You wound up with a conviction to change the world, so...
Yeah, well, that really goes back to Terry McKenna and all that. You know, the Catholic Action view of the world as I saw it, not as I say, Santa Maria and so on were peddling it. I used to sell, you know, for the society. I had a stand just outside the caf door there, and we had publications to sell, and There was a communist guy standing right beside me with the, and we'd swapped the Catholic worker.
Were you in one of the clubs?
Yeah, the Newman Society. But we were swapping the Catholic worker for the communist papers at the time and so on. And he said to me, "What's this? Oh, this is not that day. What's Santa Cruz paper again? This is not the News Weekly. This is, oh, that's not, I'm not that rag." I said, "No, Catholic worker, that's all right." Because by that time, the Catholic worker had written the article against Santa Maria's mob that the Archbishop Mannix said that it was all outside the cathedral. Mm. So all the other priests sort of towed the line, basically. The Santa Maria thing was all, it was cliquish Catholic stuff, which we were trying to break out of. And I think it's extremely important as a formation thing in my life.
Perhaps to move to this, when you do meet your wife and her family, you mentioned they're highly intellectual roots.
Yeah, very. Jared was a solicitor, but he was one of the founders of the Campion Society of the 30s. A bunch of Catholic intellectuals, by this stage they're professionals, not students. The Newman Society was a new step because it took it into the student world. But the Campion Society, Frank Maher and a lot of guys, McInerney, all became judges and QCs, and, you know, Connor, more or less. Santa Maria was in it, but he got more and more marginalised from this sort of field. And so there was Jared, an extremely important influence, and Frank would probably be very interested in it, was Jared Heffey's brother, Jack Heffey, who was a priest. Jack had gone to Propaganda College in Rome to study, which is a propagation of the faith. It's not a political thing, propagation of the faith group. He'd come back with mates like Archbishop Billy Young and so on through America as the war had already started, and remembered saying, "Bloody hell, what the Japanese think they're doing. I've seen the sort of the American industrial world, you know." Mm. And he came back here and he decided that there was no way Christianity could penetrate society while it had capitalist roots. And so he went off to Whitlands up in northeast Victoria and with others set up a community which had their own cows and plots of land and their own mission chapel and all that sort of stuff.
Was it all male? Was it all male?
No, female. It was an interesting point because it wasn't under Archbishop Mannix, it was under the Bishop of Bendigo, I think, or Ballarat, one of those two. He was a bit worried by the fact that there were unmarried men and unmarried women living in such close proximity. And eventually they were recalled.
But it was a church thing, right?
Yeah, well, no, it had no church thing, except that Jack Heffey as a priest was on his guard because of all this sort of this fear of scandal. The priest was recalled, so the community folded without the priest. That's how they saw it in those days. And they marched on Raheen. Archbishop Mannix said no. But the significant thing about that community was that this belief that you can't live a fully Christian life within the confines of a capitalist society. And the other one was Europe is the faith. Hilaire Belloc, Chesterton, these guys strongly influenced their way of thinking. Salvador de Madriaga and all these sort of European thinkers. Mm. So you started to get this notion of the small, not evangelical, what's the Catholic word for it, community, right, that would eventually show the world a different way. There wasn't a lot of writing associated with this. There was a lot of talking and singing and so on. So that when the sort of hippie thing came, a lot of them, you know, odd bods mainly, who couldn't fit in, actually finished up with Jack, or not a lot of them, quite a few of them, poets and people. They wanted to opt out, but Jack didn't quite like all that because it had pot associated with it, and a lot of them were mad anyway and so on. Jared wrote for the Catholic Worker, he was the one who, while he never joined the Labor Party himself, had six children, five of them were lawyers, and the sixth one married a lawyer. It was a highly stimulating sort of place to go there to dinner, right? And you talked about the events of whatever was prominent and so on. Big talkers, highly emotional, and, you know, everybody at each other and so on. The very emotional times of anti-Santa Mariaism.
You're listening to The Study, and we're talking to Len Pugliese, urban environmental planner. In the second half of this talk, Len goes on to talk about urban planning and how he got into it and how it led on later to his interest in environmentalism.
There is a belief the government can constructively influence the way capitalism works. You later on, you must have had some sort of belief that you could work in a framework where the government could influence the way things developed.
The planning thing is interesting, but I think you've got to go back further with me. I didn't come to it via the state. I came to it via an interest in cities. By sitting with my, you know, my uncle for that year in the milk bar, and every night when we'd finish, he'd shift everything off the table, and he'd sit down with house plans, and he'd decide, these subdivisions are all wrong, you can't set out houses properly. And so that when I got married and went overseas, I was just remembering with Marilyn. We went by boat in those days because they didn't go by plane. I took Lewis Mumford's The Culture of Cities with me to read. Okay, so when you come back and it's 1965, 1966, I'm still churning over these things. So I decided to do a diploma in planning, right, part-time while I was still working in the law. In 1970... Well, I had planning cases, not very large ones, but planning cases when I was in the law, attending before the appeals tribunal and so on. So, these issues were foremost in my mind, and I decided there was only one way, really, that I was interested in, wasn't in the law, was in getting into it direct. I found a job in the Board of Works. As soon as I got into it, the planning field was was pretty flat, actually. It was 1970. Nothing much was being achieved. You had this zoning scheme. But two things came together by 71, 72 to change all that, to give it to give my life a completely new excitement. And the first one was that they brought out the corridor scheme for Melbourne, where you had huge swathes of land set aside for green wedges and so on. I wasn't part of the research side of it, I was the administrative side of the scheme. But here I was going to appeals, defending the green wedge, you know, people coming into the offices and saying, where am I, where am I? I'm in the pink bit. I'm in the green bit. Oh, what does that mean? What can I do about it? You know, so it was this highly charged time. And secondly, the board had brought in a condition that all subdivision was to have reticulated sewerage as a condition. And, you know, once again, you know, this was a big environmental thing, and people were saying this is going to put up the price of land, it's going to do, you know, so all this. So that was the one side of it. So there was excitement at last in the board. And the other side of it was Whitlam coming to power. I was lucky to leave the Board of Works and go to the Town and Country Planning Board, and they were involved in the state side of the Albury-Wodonga development project. So I got caught up in that. As personal assistant to the chairman. Backwards and forwards to Canberra and Sydney and Albury-Wodonga and, you know, meetings and getting a sense of money galore floating around, land being purchased and all this sort of stuff. And new planners, I mean, they were just completely different. And we had guys coming from America. So this little lego administrative brain that I had suddenly just got blown apart by money and new ideas. And from there, it sort of you know, that's really the start of the whole planning thing. So my belief was always controlled as to what government could do, because I saw government as regulatory. And then, of course...
But this is a different culture, then, isn't it, to the laissez-faire market thing?
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, that's right.
People believe that government had a role, tinge of social engineering in it as well.
That's right. Oh, it was very bad in many of its results. You know, I mean, when they bought up all these farms and so on, paid very large dollars.
The possibilities of people being different, taking a different course of development somehow, anyhow, it's sort of like this, it's such a totalitarian thing now that this so-called market economic rationalist point of view.
Well, it's a big question. It brings us right up to today. The thing about it is that I'm pretty depressed, actually, in the sense that at this moment I don't think there is the impetus. If you go back, all my great leaps, exciting leaps, have always been in association with other people. That, you know, the right back to the school YCW stuff, the Newman Society, the participants, the young town planning profession. I don't feel, and I'm getting old and at a distance, right? I don't feel associated with anything like that. I can see a diffuse one, friends doing this and doing that, and colleagues and people in the States and in Europe and, you know, doing these things, right? But I personally am not associated with what I believe are the sorts of groupings and so on that change the world, right? That have a marked effect anyway. You've got to remember one other highly emotional thing, and that is that I decided in the 50s that I was part of this country, not part of Italy. It was a decision. Having been to Italy and all that sort of stuff, I thought I was completely different to those people. I mean, I'm sorry I did make as strong a break as that, in a sense. You know, it was being Australian. But what became significant, you've got to realise, in the 70s, in my development, was that the planning thing was very England articulated. We were surrounded by lots of guys that had come from England. The system had English, you know, terminology. The journals that we read were only English stuff, you know, structure plans and all that sort of policy plan. All that sort of stuff was very English. And it wasn't until Peter Fisher came along to the board, I think it was about Down and Country Planning Board, which was about 77, 78, he'd got a Fulbright scholarship, went to the United States and studied and worked in Berkeley. He worked on an evaluation of the BART scheme, you know, the BART scheme, and so on, with lots of the top professors and planners and so on at Berkeley. His background was physics and maths, but with an interest in politics and that. So when he went there, he found the Americans, he found himself in a more amenable situation where, you know, the notion of quantitative analysis was there. I mean, for me, it was a complete no-no. I mean, we were British administration, and then with the legal background, I mean, I kept thinking about what the law allowed you to do and all that.
Well, this is very much, I suppose, the tradition of the public service.
Yeah, that's right. I could question the way the administration worked because of my legal background. I mean, I had studies in administrative law, which made you ask, because these guys were really working intravires, as we used to say, you know, within the legal, or were they ultravires and all that? Those sort of questions worried me. These were completely new. It was economic, quantitative. It started all these planning articles where we had equations in them and things, you know. This was a whole different way of looking at it. And Fisher could understand it all, but he brought analysis so that, you know, the English way, for example, said, you know, that we protect our city cores and we do this and we do that, you know. And he just asked questions, well, you know, who's going to benefit and who's going to who's going to suffer from all this? And he could do some of that quantitative analysis, which I had no idea even existed, basically. My first real involvement, where I was personally pushing the conservation barrow, was that I was made chairman of a Macedon Rangers Statement of Planning Policy Implementation Committee, and most of the policies there were conservation-type policies. And the committee consisted of councillors from the local councils and state government representatives from forestry and conservation, all these sorts of people. So we were pushing the preservation or conservation of that very hard. It was a sort of an accommodating thing, right? There's going to be growth. How do we manage it, sort of stuff. There was no ecological penetration or anything like that. It was just preserving it and so on. The 80s took another turn completely, because somewhere in the 80s, the big problem became employment. That was at the top of everybody's agenda. I'm going to have to say that probably the most creative time for me, though, was in that hiatus between the end of the 70s and the early 80s, where I devised a program for the then Department Ministry of Planning called Planning System Review. And it sought to bridge the sort of planning and legal-administrative concepts in my mind. Well, as I described earlier, I had a legal administrative mind, right, that sort of said how you'd do this within the powers. I began to articulate and get the powers that be in the Town Country Planning Board and the ministries to see, look, these things intermesh. There are the substantive planning issues, whether the city should be consolidated or whether it should have more public transport, less public transport, more cars, whatever, right? Those sort of substantive issues. But there was also the planning system, and the planning system really dealt with the mechanisms of planning. And I articulated those. They deal with the instruments of planning, the organisations, the statement of the ends, and, you know, other issues like public participation, all those sorts of things. So that the planning system itself needed to be kept under surveillance. Like we keep the changing city forms and structures under surveillance, the planning system itself has to be kept under surveillance. And I called it planning system review. And I said, unless you get all the things right, people set about, say, changing the Act. The Act's out of date. We'll change the Act. I said, you can't just change the Act. It involves the regulations, it involves all the guidelines that tell you how to operate, the public seeing things differently, it involves different training of planners and all that sort of stuff. That all these things have to be kept under surveillance and review. So much so that I'd established people who were thinking along these lines, that when in the 90s Kennett's mob came in with Rob McClellan, he actually made a speech in which he haw-hawed the fact that the bureaucracy has got itself a basis to survive forever, because they can go on reviewing forever. But what I want to do is change the Act and change the schemes, right? Yeah. And words of that were effective. You said, now, I mean, I feel a little bit of justification, if I can allow it, in that they've done everything, but the planners have left the system. If you go to any council now, they're in dire trouble because they haven't got any planners there. You know, they haven't got nearly enough planners to do what this monstrous, substantive changes have imposed on the system. It was seeing this whole integration thing that, you know, and of course governments and ministers don't like words like holistic and integrated and all that sort of stuff, right? But that was something that I had actually introduced in the late 70s, early 90s, a way of thinking into the system. But that was probably the most creative moment in my professional life in that I actually articulated, brought the thought, where the thoughts come from, God knows, but it came into there, right? The 80s then, when I saw that that wasn't going to survive or have much, I began then to associate with, again, with Peter Fisher, and he was articulating this new environmental management sector for government intervention. He wrote a paper, which I then praised for him, and said, what you're saying is there needs to be another sector called environmental management. And we set this out. He was trying to work in with planning, and I was trying to feed him stuff and so on. But once again, that went because everybody started saying, oh, right, what they want is office park zones and technology zones and so on. And it all, once again, came to be brought down to the, you know, the legal structures. And instead of what all this stuff's about, you know, is about ideas and linkages across industry and across all sorts of areas of, you know, science and universities and all that sort of stuff. And technology precincts. I mean, it was Peter working with Professor Ed Blakely from the States, who was a local economic development guy, who started to put together the Monash, the concept of the Monash precinct. And but once again, our boys just took over with real lack of imagination and just sort of said, oh, well, we'll put the zone in and then it's up to somebody else to do it. So here you have two things in the 80s. You have economic growth, employment, and you had the inspirational stuff about the place of new technology. Oh, and the third one was Peter's articulation of the environmental management sector. So that was really what I was caught up in. Now, you get to the 90s. I'm down at Werribee. I'd come across the guys there because that was one area where you were going to have a tech precinct based on the agricultural strengths, the college strengths down there and so on. They had their own economic development unit, which was a first for any municipality at that stage. And so I didn't get put into that. I got to work as personal assistant to the city engineer. And he gave me particular tasks like community centres. You know, we were very conscious of environmental clean-up. All that stuff was there. And we wanted the National Air and Space Museum established down at Point Cook. And, you know, this was going to be change the image of the West. We'd have a high-profile facility down there which would attract people and so on. Environment stuff I was reading a lot of, but as I say, it was only a factor. I was certainly concerned about the big issues of the environment.
Any key works, any particular books?
I started to read, you know, World Watch, for example, Lester Brown stuff. I would have been reading it well in the late 80s. Yeah, those sorts of things. It became more philosophical through the 90s. I started to pick up stuff by E.O. Wilson and, and I'd listen to talks and do all those things, right? And that's really how it's sort of grown through the 90s. There's no way, you see, this is my problem from now on. There's no way that I can be credible talking about these things or writing about them because I don't have a scientific background. And at this age, you can't learn new words. Even if I sit down now and read, you know, an article about cloning or something, right? I'll read it and I'll, you know, stay with it and so on. But I cannot then get up and go to somebody and say, this is what it's about, right? It's just, it doesn't hook on anymore. And I suppose I've got to recognise this. And that's why I've tried to write within the area of my expertise, which is a bit of the planning stuff and, you know, how houses, I mentioned merchant builders, gardens, all that sort of stuff. I mean, these are the areas where I've been, touching on.
Has your outlook about the environment, about what it is, changed? I mean, for example, if I mention the word nature, how do you view nature?
Do you know Tim Winton's The Riders? In The Rider, he's in Ireland or Europe or something, he says, or he refers to Europe, and he says, here where the wild is no longer even a memory. That's what I associate nature with, the wild, the key thought, the wild. To me, Australia is an amazing sort of home of the wild. That's the sort of emotional thing that I'm thinking about.
One of the subtopics there is this idea of closeness to nature. I want to sort of question that idea in a way. I mean, there's a whole lot of other issues that sort of come out of that. I mean, you get somebody like Wordsworth, for example, that he believed that a love of nature would lead to a love of mankind. He spent the rest of his life unsuccessfully trying to prove that. And in fact, I suggest that it can easily go the other way, that a love of nature now could lead to an anti-humanist position. There are people that regard human race as a blight on the planet.
Now what about Berry's sort of view, the American? If human beings were living on the moon, we'd be very different. That nature is feeding into us stuff, colour, diversity, influences in our human capacity in various ways, you know?
Yeah. Well,
that we'd be quite different creatures on that. So there is this interaction.
Violence and cruelty is part of it too.
Yeah, I know. There's all, okay, and we read that for what it is and so on. It's that interaction.
Extinction is a natural part of nature.
Yeah, I know.
Right, well,
I mean, okay, all I'd say is, you know, I'd have to turn to people like E.O. Wilson and so on in consilience and just talk about it, because we're in an area where people are asking, is there a future for human nature and all that. I mean, it's more than my non-philosophical mind.
But you're thinking and reading.
Can I just put this in, because I've written it in one of the papers, and that is that I'm very scared about the development that's happening in urban planning with the, not so much the consolidation movement. I mean, I can see there's grounds for higher density stuff and so on, but to the extent that it detaches people from easy contact with the land, at least in these sorts of places. In fact, we're losing it a bit even, you know, when we lost growing of vegetables and having chooks around and having a dog and all those sorts of things. We're losing some of the feel. And I get horrified by people saying, oh, I'm leaving the suburbs because I'm sick of cutting lawns. I mean, I don't believe for one moment that that's all they saw in living with land around you. But if they did, it's a terrible shame because there's so much being lost by what people have learnt about that contact and so on.
This comes right to a subject you already mentioned the word before, dear to my heart lately, the garden philosophy. I'd like you to talk about that a bit.
I've written my paper about it, and where I called it Native and Productive on Our Patch, and it talks about the sort of environmental imperatives as to why we should see our patch, right, as important. Perhaps I'd just say I believe that there are lots of opportunities, you know, even on a thing this size, and I'd like to have a bigger piece of land.
Bigger.
Not smaller. Yeah.
No lawn.
Yeah, no, I haven't got any lawn. I'd like to have where I could actually do more. It's so much an educative thing. I mean, I know so little about native plants, about growing vegetables. I mean, it's terrible how much I've lost, and I think that the global thing is going to make it important that we find out a bit more about growing our own bloody vegetables. And it's not trivial.
Another subject it's not trivial.
They produce 45% of their food in during the war on Victory Gardens, as they called them in the United States, right? Just in their home gardens.
I'm interested also in the art side of this that you call art, I suppose, and the Italians have been, of course, a major...
Bloody Tuscans.
Force, yeah, the Tuscans, yeah.
I see it more at the permaculture self-sufficiency end rather than the design end. My interest is at that end, but I'm not intolerant of people at the other
end. Well, I think you've got to have both. But I hate these over-designed, arid-looking things you see on TV now.
Minimalist.
Skinny trees. All that
stuff, terrible.
There's no room for the wild things to come in.
The pedophiles of the natural world. I suppose I'm given more to moral compulsion than I am to the artistic. In other words, I think that there are serious ethical reasons, there are serious survival reasons, if you want to put that.
Well,
we've got to be more concerned about the other dimension rather than...
This is really my very next...
artistic dimension.
...question, in a way. You have...
frightened of the effete in the Italian, if you really want to know.
Yeah.
That's an end of the Italian, which I think is quite frightening. And what they describe about the way the so-called cultivated, cultured life of the cities has led, seems to me to have no real future. Maybe it's the blood and guts Sicilian background or something that says that life's tough and you've got to make a living out of it and all that sort of stuff that's coming through in me. I don't know. But it's that end of the thing, the social responsibility, my feeling about problems of the future and all that sort of survival and so on, is the end of the world that I look at rather than the artistic end. Marilyn's much more interested in the other side, and she... we go into a town...
Can I just ask you, you alluded to the spiritual side back in the 50s when you were growing up.
Yeah.
That was an important thing there. I was wondering maybe...
You're not going to ask me about God now.
But I'd like to come back to that. I mean, you can tell me if you like, but I'd like to come back...
I don't know the answer
to that. But part of the reason I want to ask you about that is you've just alluded to the ethical side of it. I mean, where do you think we get our ideas about how to live, our values... virtues and so forth. Where do these derive from then? They're often derived from a religion. But
yeah. Well, with me they were. I mean, it'd be stupid to say I could possibly throw it off, right? The Italian Christian upbringing.
Well, I'm interested in stories, for example. Okay. Like, is the Christian story still relevant to you?
It is. I might describe it these days as mythological, as a myth, but using that in the sense of the stories we tell ourselves that give our life meaning. That's how I use the word myth, and that's the story. And the Christian story is, in my book, terrific. I don't have any experience with others, but of the others I've read about, the Buddhism seems most attractive. But I couldn't supplant that Christian thing out anymore, right? I just, there's no way I could dig it out of myself, certainly not at this age anyway. But the notion that, all the unevenness, the inequality, that all that is going to be evened out in the next world, I just can't see that. I think we're too physically, biologically based in our origins and our development to accept such a sort of off-the-planet sort of view of where it's all going to come to. I think that even within the Christian story, there is room to more fully grasp the significance of all the other species of this life, right, on this world. The Christian story has limited itself too much to the human dimension. See, one of the great myths of Christianity was that not just that everybody will be saved, but that there is a communion of saints, that there will be a society where everybody that you love and loves their God and so on will be there together in harmony and rejoicing and music, and that all the other beauties of the world, right, are going to be there as part of that great rejoicing. That's an incredibly strong and very powerful sort of image. Does my mind grasp it? Does my rationality grasp it? I just question it. Does it say it uplifts us if we think about it in those terms? I think it might. But that's as far as I can go in all this. It's an unresolved thing. It's this business of this, you know, this grouping, which I said to you, I've only ever seen what I see development or real change coming from, you know, a group, people falling in together and deciding that, you know. One of the things I've discovered, you know, it's the hole in the wall group and so on, is that as you get older, that doesn't happen anymore. People have all got their own things that they're doing and their stubbornnesses and all this sort of thing. And you become isolated and you can talk in friendship to people, but that's as far as it goes.
You know, looking back over your life, yeah, whether you see any overall trends and maybe give a sort of bit of a forward projection.
I'd have to say that there isn't the forward impetus at this moment that I see as strong enough to change things, right? In giving an ecological perspective as the central push, or I'm trying to think another way.
Do you think that was ever there, or was it just a delusion?
No, it wasn't ever there. It hasn't been. No, it's a definite. It's a paradigm shift that's needed.
I'll ask you one more question, Len, to do with sort of activism versus the contemplative life, I suppose. You probably have a bit of both of that.
How do you find psychological distinctions still used? When I was a kid, everybody talked about active personalities and contemplative one. I was put in the contemplative one for some reason.
Well, some people are out and about a hell of a lot more. Others spend a lot of time inside listening to music, reading books.
My father used to say, Lenny, he thinks a little much.
You can do, I mean, you can combine both. What I'm interested in is your personal equation there. Where do you find your happiness?
Well, in both. One of the lovely things about being in retirement, and I've sort of expressed it a different way to Marilyn recently, is that she's interested in art and architecture and thing, and she says, and she doesn't actually say, I haven't got time to do that or do that because I've got to think about work. She doesn't say that because she's not boring, but I can affect her, you see. And one of the things I've felt about it is that being retired, you can actually let your mind go deeper into things. And that's why I'm saying it's easy for things on the side to be forgotten or to vanish. And you actually do go deeper and deeper. And the way I've said it to her is that you can allow things to resonate, is the modern word, you know, to sort of roll down further and, I don't have to stop there. I can ask that question too. And that question too, you know, think along those lines that you mightn't have done because you thought, oh, shit, I've got bloody lawns, guard, dig or whatever. So what was your question, sorry?
I think in the
contemplative active thing, I try to do that, but I'm also very, very conscious of falling into a, not a loneliness, I don't think that'll ever happen, but a loss of the wonderful value of interaction with people. And I actively go to things and so on because I want to be able to say g'day, and because people are then telling you what the world is in that is sense, you know, and what's happening and what's driving them. So I like them both. I would never say I'm just going to close that door and think. Mm-hmm. I never do that.
Well, it's been quite a while between podcasts in my study. Such are the costs of moving house. The study is once again focusing strongly on human origins. We'll be doing some investigation on that one in Southern Africa soon. That region has proven as important in the human story as East Africa and the Great Rift Valley, as a recent find of a new Australopithecine species outside Johannesburg has amply demonstrated. Of course, it's a long, long journey from those times and places to the city. Like Lynn Pugliese, I found Lewis Mumford, for example, an influential thinker. His book, The City and History, a critical account of the rise of the big modern city, was a fascinating work in a youthful phase of my intellectual life. Perhaps it was because of another theme I keep nagging at, and that is civilization. Not so much its history, but what it is. And, well, what is it indeed? I don't know, but I try and think about the answer. A.N. Whitehead, in his book Adventures of Ideas, states, "The notion of civilization is very baffling. I too am certainly still in a very tentative frame of mind about this elusive idea. It suggests an ideal for the individual and for a society, but the senses of the word civilized are different in the two cases. It's something that is not discussed much, not nearly as much as it ought to be. I certainly respect some of the ideas of Kenneth Clark. He tried to get at it in the classic TV series Civilization, in particular about a state of society that produced the confidence to undertake large and long-term creative projects. But there is no doubt that confusion reigns in our attitudes about it. We tend to take it for granted if we are fortunate enough to live in a period like Clark spoke of. But at once we will sneer at it, yet we expect it to provide us with an ambulance full of high-tech medicine within 15 minutes. We wouldn't be without civilization in a fit. Well, how to define it? As Whitehead states, we proceed by examples. Some of the confusion is to do with the use of the noun, civilization, and the adjective, civilized. Were Nazi Germany, Stalin's Soviet Union, the Aztecs' Mexico, were they civilizations? Unfortunately, we'd have to say yes, even if these examples help with our sneering. Conversely, we can ask, were Australian Aboriginal societies uncivilized? We'd have to say no. Having written about William Buckley, I know which of the four examples just named I'd rather have lived in. Well, the dictionaries don't say it, but civilization, however cruel, is to do with the city. Civilization has become a no-return phase of human evolution, as surely as walking or talking. Or, well, has it? One of the things that I cannot disregard about walking and talking is that from whenever they started, at least 4 million years for walking, and I think over 1 million years for talking, to this day, we have to be taught these skills. Whatever evolution has done to us, for us, they don't come naturally. So, what does that mean? Well, for civilization, the same must apply. Whatever civilization might be, it doesn't just happen, and it doesn't necessarily keep getting better. We have to apply ourselves to the process, the cultural transfer across the generations. The sort of urban planning that Lynn Pugliese spent his career working at is part of that. I don't think planning makes much difference to the noun, but it may be absolutely pivotal to the adjective, which at the end of the day seems more important. Being civilized is more important than simply living in a civilization. But better still, we should endlessly recreate the physical environment where the elusive qualities of the noun and the adjective mingle fruitfully. And I guess I'm a bit more snaky than Lynn Pugliese, and I will say, at least until next time, it's shut the door and reading lamp only in the study. Music in this program included my two favourite themes, the Bach Prelude played by Ronald Farren Price and the Handel Suite played by Elizabeth Anderson, both from Move Records. Full details are on the study webpages.